Well, I'd like to welcome all of our listeners to another episode of the London Lyceum. I'm one of your hosts, Jordan Stefaniak, and we're a podcast that's dedicated to serious thinking for a serious church. And the way we've tried to describe that, if you're brand new to listening or if you've listened to all of our episodes, is just simply we're trying to create or sustain or encourage an intellectual culture of various things like charity, curiosity, critical thinking, and cheerful confessionalism. So we could go into depth on all those, but the main idea is simply like we want to be interested in what other people are saying and thinking on a broad range of topics and to approach it with the right sort of mindset. So we want to come at it with an opportunity to learn, to be open-minded, but that doesn't mean that we then just relegate all the sort of rigor and the potential objections to the sideline and just everybody kind of hold hands and sing kumbaya. We want to actually have rigorous debate and discussion the way, you know, you would anticipate and expect most educational institutions were supposed to be and should be. And so that's what we've tried to do and encourage with the podcast. So we talk to all sorts of people about all sorts of topics, and it's a lot of fun. Today, I'm looking forward to introducing you all again, for those who are regular listeners, to Dr. Glenn Buttner. We'll be talking about one of his recent books called Work Out Your Salvation. And this is from Fortress, and it's discussing the nature of markets and economic aspects. And it for me, I've really enjoyed this book. Now, I definitely am into economics probably more than some of the seminarians who listen or professors who listen to this. But I think everybody's involved in this, especially if you're living in a developed country. So it's applicable to where you're at. Glenn, this is going to be a lot of fun. So the last I checked, though, let me check while I'm recording right now. I think your book was very affordable. so if I go to... If I just search your last name, it does not give me what I want. So Amazon tells me right now that your book is $6 and the list price is $49. So if it stays that way when you're listening to this, you need to go pick up a copy because there's like no reason to. It's a hardcover. Like, I don't know what we're doing.
It's right markets here. In action. That's right. The demand is quite low, so the price has dropped. So,
well, the demand should increase significantly after hopefully listening to this and enjoying it. So, Glenn, tell me a little bit about yourself and what was it that inspired writing this book?
Yeah, so I am a theologian and social ethicist. For a couple of months now, I have been living up in the Boston area, working at Gordon-Conwell Theological Seminary, but most of my professional career I've spent in rural Kansas, teaching undergraduates and running an honors program, which gave me a lot of opportunities to interact with students in, you know, the business majors. And so that's one thing that sort of kept this fire alive, is trying to think, how does my faith relate to those students I had that are going to one day be working, you know, in a 9-to-5 job that doesn't involve most of those hours reading books. So sad for them. Really the roots of the book go back a lot earlier. I went to college, University of North Carolina, wanting to do law, human rights law. So was in the political science department and really was displeased with how they were teaching political science. They had this thing called rational choice theory that was all about just go out and maximize your votes, get all the votes you can. And that's all that there is. There should be no role for ethics, just do what gets you votes. That'll keep you in power. That represents people anyway. And it was basically an optimization problem taken over from economics and applied to politics without, you know, any of the ethical parameters, any of the robust political philosophy from the past. And so I dropped my political science major. I got a little disgruntled with the whole system and decided I wanted to go do academic work and think about, you know, where we went wrong. I picked up an economics major along the way, because who gets a job as a theologian? And I needed a fallback. But through studying that, I began to realize actually a lot of the questions and concerns I had were rooted in economics more than an actual political theory. Meanwhile, I'm going through seminary and eventually a doctoral program. And a lot of people are just saying, oh, capitalism makes you virtuous, or, oh, capitalism totally corrupts your soul. And I thought both of those theses lacked nuance. And so I wanted to take my knowledge of economics and kind of think about some problems with our economy while also thinking about how we can have a more accurate and truthful theological account of what's happening in the economy. So that led to the book, and I guess kind of reveals a little bit of my nerdy past. And Yeah, it's great to be on. It's great to be back. This is going to be a different conversation than we had last time on the Trinity. So it's going
to
be fun.
Well, you should go listen to that if you haven't already. You can go find it in the catalog. Now, I think this is, maybe it is nerdy, but I'm going to nerd out with you because I think it's super interesting. So maybe let's just start with the baseline at the beginning. When we're talking about markets, what exactly are we talking about?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I have a whole chapter sort of defining what I mean by markets. Basically, markets are an imagined space. And by that, I mean that everybody involved has to think of certain physical and social things as buyable and sellable according to certain rules. So we can walk into an art gallery and we don't think of it as a market because we don't think that we can buy the Picasso up on the wall, but we can walk into, I guess some galleries you can buy. We can walk into, one of the stores that artists have up here on, the northeast shores of Boston and immediately know that these pieces of art are for sale. Both buildings are just some paintings up on a wall, but it's the way that I imagine those spaces that helps me to see it as a market. And then once I know it's a market, I'm going to be able to buy and sell things based on certain information. Usually that includes price, but I might know lots of other information, so nutrition information at the grocery store, terms of contract for a mortgage when buying a house. There's going to be a certain mechanism by which I trade. So it could be an auction. It could just be a flat, I pay what the sticker price is. It could be haggling. There are lots of different ways to actually do that trade. And then there's usually going to be some sort of regulation about who is able to buy and sell. And if I just walk in with some watercolors I did and say, hey, I'm going to sell this here in your, fine art store, they're going to laugh at me and kick me out. And so a market is sort of the agglomeration of all of these rules within this imagined space where we see it as either a physical place or, even a digital space like Amazon, where we buy and sell things according to these rules and based on this information. So that's what I mean when I'm talking about a market.
Yeah. So, and I'm not sure if I'm going to be going organized through the book here with what I'm thinking about, because you just say things and I get in asking questions about it.
That works for me. I'm not very organized myself. So,
so one of the key questions obviously in the book is how do markets, contribute to or impede moral formation? And you mentioned, as you were describing this, it seems like there's almost two ends of the spectrum when you're looking at the approaches to this from a theological viewpoint, where there's people who say markets are all bad, particularly capitalism. And then you have the other people who kind of say, well, no, there's nothing wrong with them. It's great. I think you use the analogy of, a rising tide rises all boats. Some different people say that to support sort of a market framework. And I think I've seen that, but I didn't realize the actual figures and the specific groups. So like you talk about the ecclesial ethicists. I had no idea these people existed. like what is their reason, for example, for being suspicious of markets? And are there any potential nuances that they're missing to have such a dim view?
Yeah, sure. So ecclesial ethicists, that's terminology that kind of comes out of my master's degree at Duke, which is a big center of this way of thinking. It stems from ethicists like Stanley Hauerwas, Sam Wells, who think that Christian ethics should be oriented toward the church. And so we're going to be shaped by the liturgies of the church, by the Eucharist, especially by the grand narrative of salvation as it affects our moral understanding, and by the virtues that we're able to develop in the community of Christians. And so the problem fundamentally is that markets aren't the church. That's putting it a bit simply, but if moral formation happens in that way, then, a la James K.A. Smith, we have cultural liturgies in the marketplace that are often competing with our church liturgies. And so these practices that we do over and over in the marketplace might tend to corrupt us. We have alternative communities of the corporation that are oriented toward profit rather than the community of the church that's oriented toward God's glory and witnessing what he has accomplished through Christ as we're empowered by the Holy Spirit. It's a very different community. And so if virtue is formed in community, the argument is you're going to form vices, actually, if your community is fundamentally structured around the profit motive. And so you can see different ethicists, Steve Long, for example, talking about multinational corporations as having a competing Catholicity with the church. And I think there's a lot of validity there. I think we do need to be critical of the world. You know, it's a fallen world. And so we should expect things in the economy that will shape us poorly, that will compete with our Christian calling, that will critique the church. And yet, I try and argue for an account of common grace in the book that suggests that God is working graciously through all of creation. It's not to say that all of creation is saved, but God can be encountered and grace is active everywhere, which leads me to suspect that we can actually be sanctified in places outside of the church. You know, what happens to the person that's working two jobs to take care of their family and maybe they squeeze in an hour at church on Sunday? Are they just cut off from grace? Well, I'd like to think not. But I think a lot of it depends on how we structure markets, as well as, you know, how the individual interacts within markets. But one problem with ecclesial ethics is they tend to treat markets just as a monolithic entity that has no variety. Capitalism is just one thing. Socialism is another thing. And generally from this perspective, socialism is better, though sometimes they want, you know, more agrarian economies or something. The same thing, though, could be said of a lot of defenders of capitalism, by the way. You know, capitalism is this one thing and it's good. Markets are this one thing and they're good. But actually, you can structure markets in a lot of different ways, which raises the question, which ways actually make us worse, like the ecclesial ethicists are worried about, and which ways actually might not impede our sanctification so that God can make us better?
Yeah, that's good. So, one question I have is a distinction. When someone talks about capitalism, is that a specific type of market economy, or is that sometimes used in a synonymous way of just markets in general?
I think it's often used imprecisely to refer to markets. Often it's used with slightly more precision just to refer to you know, a system where there's private ownership of the means of production and where there's free exchange in markets based on the price mechanism. I think I try to stay away. The word shows up a lot in the book because it's hard to escape in these discussions, but I try to stay away too much from evaluating capitalism per se and looking instead at markets, because there are going to be parts of capitalism that aren't really market-based. Just as there are going to be markets active even in, you know, the most extreme communistic societies, even if maybe they're the black market. So I think market gives us a lot more specificity maybe than capitalism does, even while it totally drops the question of property and ownership, which is really important. But I hardly even touch on that in the book.
Yeah. So you have like one chapter especially dedicated to all these different empirical studies and the results from them. One of the studies that I found most interesting was the daycare example. And I'd be interested in hearing, like, because I think the result from that was sort of, if we introduce a price mechanism that can disincentivize people from viewing certain things as a moral obligation of some sort. I found that really interesting. So I'd love for you just to sort of unpack that. Do you think that's true in all types of contexts, or is it true in just certain types of contexts?
Yeah, great question. So the experiments, they're one of my favorite things in economics. You know, behavioral and experimental economists going out and saying, well, let's actually figure out how people act if we change markets. And that's the data set that I think a lot of theologians have just completely ignored. And so I'm trying to draw on that. And actually, one of my favorite examples, which is why I put it prominently early in the book, is the daycare example. And so some Israeli economists say, well, let's see what happens if we institute fines at daycares where parents are now going to have to pay if they're late picking up their kids. And their hypothesis is, if we increase the price of being late from free to $20, parents are going to start being more on time. They have a good control group of daycares they don't change, and they have these other daycares that they do change. What they find is actually late pickups increase because, well, they don't know why. So they throw out a couple of theories, and the main theory, the one that I find the most persuasive, is that they have shifted the framework from one of moral obligation. I need to be late because I have a responsibility toward these teachers who have other things to do. So I have a duty to get here for my kids, to a market exchange where I can now purchase an extra hour of childcare for $20 and continue doing what I need to do. The interesting thing, though, is once the fines were dropped, that late behavior continued. So that moral framework had shifted. Now, how broadly does that apply? It's a bit funny. I've not had a chance to do a lot of public discussion of this, but the one that I did was with two economists and a theologian. And the economists both kind of pushed back on me a little bit and said, you know, you're trusting this economic data a little bit too much. Experimental economics is new. At the same time, there's kind of a battle within the world of economics in terms of how behavioral are we going to become. So I was having lunch the other day with an economist that is all in. He's like, this is it. This is totally reformulates economics. This is what we need to do. And my abilities in, you know, econometrics and the mathematics of economics are not strong enough for me to have absolute certainty on the debate. So I think it seems to me that, you know, the theory makes sense. And there are a lot of studies that have found this in a lot of contexts. Human beings differ. So not everybody's going to respond in the same way, but there is a pattern here. And so the data is strong enough to me that I would be hesitant to use those sort of incentives, because they then push us out of that moral framework that I think is so important, I argue in a later chapter, for sanctification. So even if the data is spurious, if we can debate the extent to which this happens, the possibility of that risk weighed relative to the potential benefits of, you know, one or two less late parents a month, like, I would not institute those fines. And when we structure so much of our economy based on incentives and fines, the cumulative effect of that in so many domains could be very concerning for our moral formation. So that's one of the big things I bring up in the last chapter of the book, actually, is what are we doing with incentives? Why are we relying on these so much and trying to change behavior through money instead of through moral appeal? And I think that's one place where the ecclesial ethicist would be quite right, that it's very morally concerning for our formation and sanctification.
Yeah, I mean, I think the whole thing is really, really interesting. And similarly, I think there was maybe a couple of examples I can't remember about how people give out fair economic outcomes. And let's bracket out what a fair economic outcome is. Let's just say, you know, people are getting their fair share, and just assume that as take fair, whatever you mean by that. But there was an interesting sense in which there was disproportionately more fairness when someone had sort of like undiffused responsibility and they were publicly visible. Whereas when that was shared, there seemed to be less fairness. Is that something that it seems to be common across the studies? That seems both, there's a sense in which, like, I look at that and say, yeah, that makes sense. But there's also in a sense in which it seems like more people being involved should then mitigate against it. So maybe just explain why you think that's happening.
Yeah. So I wish when I'd prepped this question, I had this example in mind and had looked it up, but there's a story about a woman. It's pretty famous and I can't remember her name, unfortunately, but she's being attacked at night in a city and she's crying out. Something like 30 people heard her. And nobody did anything because everybody kind of just assumed everybody else was going to do something. Nobody had the fixed responsibility of, I am the police caller. Nobody was obviously closer right there at the scene to feel like they needed to act. And so over the course of an hour, you know, this person kind of attacks her, a light comes on, he leaves, he comes back, and nobody acts. And it's often called something like the bystander effect. And there's just this interesting phenomenon of human psychology that, you know, sometimes we're just static when we should be acting. If we're in a group, because you're just kind of expecting, oh, somebody else will do this. And I again, not a psychologist, but I've seen enough studies for me to be convinced that this is not a weird one-off story, but that there's something behind it. And that experiments like the one I'm mentioning in the book point out that if we assign responsibility, and suddenly, Jordan, you're on community watch, you probably would have called the police right away because that's your job. If you are the one that everybody knows is on community watch, and if something happens and you didn't call the police, your neck is also on the line. You're going to be even more socially pressured to take action. And so in some of these experiments where, you know, money, real money will be given to an individual, and that individual is told you can divide this between yourself and others, and everybody knows who you are, they're going to give more to the other participants in the study. But if they're anonymous, they're more likely to keep the money for themselves. If it's two groups, group A is given all this money, group B doesn't have any, but group A can give group B however much they want. If that responsibility is diffused, they're going to probably give less to group B. And so what does that mean for markets? Well, the visibility and the clear stated responsibilities of individuals making important financial decisions are going to matter. As is the question of, does somebody have the responsibility of considering the ethical implications of certain actions, or is it just sort of diffused across the corporation where nobody's going to say or do anything? I think that's important as well. But a third implication would then be the market design itself. So you can take those same experiments. Group A gets money, and then they can give it to group B, but suddenly group B now has the opportunity of, they can reject what the offer is. And if they reject it, nobody gets any money. And if you add in that mechanism, it radically changes the distribution of money that these two groups are going to put out. And so part of it might be sort of the sociology and institutionalism of who's in charge. Do we have somebody identified? But a part of it might just be, what's the mechanism we're using to facilitate this exchange? And that's not a mechanism you're really going to see in, you know, an auto dealership. I make an offer on a car, and if the dealer doesn't like it, I lose my car or something like that. Or they list a price, and if I don't like it, they have to give me the car. We're not going to see that in the economy, but it's a weird experiment for the economics classroom that illustrates that we can change the rules by which we trade things. And it will have implications about what market equilibrium is, what sort of the default outcome is. And I think that targets the myth of there's just this natural equilibrium that comes about almost as if by providence through the invisible hand, because that equilibrium is going to change a whole lot based on how you structure the market exchange. And so again, that feeds into these questions of, are markets just or unjust? How are they forming us? It's not a yes or no answer. It depends on what mechanism you use.
Yeah, that's good. And one question I forgot to ask that I wanted to, you had a chapter discussing the fact value distinction, and whether that's true or useful in any sense. And I'd love some commentary on that, because I actually found that really interesting, even though at the beginning you were kind of like, you can skip it if you want. I really enjoyed it, so don't skip it.
Well, good. Yeah. And you're very philosophically minded. So I imagine it's right up your alley. You know, when I got my bachelor's in economics at the University of North Carolina, it's been almost 20 years at this point. So things may have changed a bit because this has been critiqued. But at the time, it was just standard. You have positive economics. We just describe what the economy is and how it works. And that's just math. And then you have normative economics. And this is the ethics side, what you ought to do. And normative economics is usually about things like, you know, welfare. Do we have welfare programs? Whereas positive economics is almost everything, and it's where the real economics is done. You know, the calculus and the, you know, complex multivariable theories and, you know, all of the elegance of Nobel Prize winning mathematical economics. The problem is, for decades now, philosophers have critiqued that sharp distinction between fact and value, not to lapse into absolute moral relativism, but the question of what facts are we going to consider is a value-laden question. So my book is asking, how do markets shape our character? That's not a question that many of those positive economists have been asking. And so they have this sort of implicit assumption that markets are not meant to be yielding ethical transformation. Whereas my understanding is the entirety of creation is being redeemed by God and is oriented toward the beatific vision, towards our moral transformation. And so if the economy is undermining this, it's working contrary to its purpose and is evil, right? And so, you know, in the name of we're looking at pure fact, they've actually bracketed this important fundamental values question. So that would be one problem. And another problem, and I raise a lot in the book, but another problem would be values are factual. So a lot of times the economists will say, you know, the normative economics is really just people's opinions. We'll just go with majority rules, you know, whatever. But I think there are objective moral values that are factual. And so we can't say, oh, values, that's for religious people to do their thing. Facts, that's what the real science is. That's what the economists are doing. Because the values are real. They matter. And so I argue that while we can distinguish between what we're doing when we're doing this mathematical positive economics and this ethical, you know, normative economics, we can't have a very sharp distinction that correlates that with one is about facts and the other is about values. And if you assume that one is about facts and the other is about values, then I don't have a seat at the table. You know, theology, Christianity doesn't have a seat at the table, because it would be kind of like, you know, us asking them to change how long division works because of the Bible. They're going to say that's ridiculous. Well, no, we're not doing something purely like long division. There's social elements of this that are very ethical. And so we have a seat at the table, a necessary one.
So you mentioned in there that, you know, as you had to, the logical positivists. And I was like, you know, I haven't seen them in a context. I've always thought of logical positivism as sort of like going to Ripley's Believe It or Not Museum, where it's like all these crazy things that, you know, existed for a period of time. No one takes them seriously. I'm like, oh, economists still take this stuff seriously. I didn't realize that was a thing. How did this downstream impact not get there?
Yeah. Well, it's funny. I don't know that many economists necessarily take the logical positivist seriously as just sort of inherit a distinction from them, you know. So, you know, a lot of sort of modern economics developed around the time of logical positivism. Yeah. So it's not surprising that, oh, you know, if it can't be verified, it's a nonsensical statement, made its way into economics. But it is kind of surprising that it's still there. Mm-hmm. Not among philosophers of economics. They tend to sort of scoff at some of this stuff, but they also tend to not have the very prominent chairs in the economics departments. They're kind of the weird ones. At least that was my experience with a philosopher of economics who's brilliant that I worked with at Marquette. He said everybody just kind of looked at him like, what are you doing? I'm doing what we need to be doing. This is important. So
one of the themes that, and you've mentioned a little bit is throughout the book, is common grace and how it's impacting markets. So maybe just work with me, like, what is common grace? Is this something that only comes with the neo-Calvinists, or is this a concept that's prior to that? And then how is it being deployed to think about markets well?
Yeah. So if a market is something more than just, you know, an individual decision, or a collection of individual decisions, if it actually takes on a life of its own that then shapes the way that I make decisions, then we need some way to talk about markets as a social reality. And if I'm asking a theological question, well, how is God working through markets? Or how is God permitting markets to impede my spiritual growth and sanctification? Then we need a social account of God's agency or inactivity there, of him handing us over to have our hearts hardened. And so I draw on common grace and on social sin as sort of those accounts. And I give definitely a Reformed account, really drawn on, you know, neo-Calvinist thought. I especially like Bavinck here and his idea of common grace oriented towards special grace, so that God is restraining sin in the world, but also enabling some non-meritorious, non-saving, you know, but feeble goodness, you know, always mixed with sin, but better than we would expect in a fallen world, because that is all oriented toward the special grace in the church and the salvation that we've been given through Christ and the Spirit. And so through that orientation, I try to argue that markets, when aligned with, you know, those gracious purposes, can feed into that special grace and enable sort of healthier Christian growth. I don't think that one has to use that exact framework. I mentioned briefly that the Nouvelle Théologie, Henri de Lubac, the natural being oriented to the supernatural, I think would give a similar metaphysic if somebody Catholic wanted to hash it out that way. And I actually know somebody that's doing some of that very work, a scholar named Christina McRory, who's going to come out with a better book than mine on market design, but from more of a Catholic perspective. But I'm Reformed myself, and so common grace was nice and easily at hand. And so I think it gives us a good way to talk about what God's doing in markets.
Yeah. Now, there's a couple of other pieces that I really want to engage here the time that we have left. One of those is, it seems like a common theme throughout the book is that market interactions are significantly influenced by institutions and social norms. So maybe walk me through that. Like, what exactly does that look like practically? Are we, when we talk about institutions, are we talking about just like my local bank? You know, I drive down the street, there's Chase. Is that who's influencing these interactions, or is it larger? I mean, I guess Chase is huge, so maybe that's not a good example. Small, let's say a local community bank versus Chase, or are we talking about other things?
Yeah. I think it's a huge range. An example of an individual car dealership. So a later chapter looks at, and I know you have a question about this later on, but a chapter looks at audit and correspondence studies. So basically, you know, we're going to send in people, different genders, ethnicities, races, to try and, you know, we'll tell them, use this strategy, to try and haggle for a price on a car and see what happens. And pretty consistently, white men are able to get the best deals in the United States. So which is good news for me, bad news for a big portion of society and a clear sign of injustice, right? That's concerning. And this local car dealership, it's actually from North Carolina. I'm trying to remember its name, but you can read about it in Wong and Ray's book on business for the common good. They realized that this haggling system was actually hurting the people, you know, that were poorest. So they were actually looking at socioeconomic class. And so they stopped. They said, we're just going to go with sticker price. And so that sort of policy that now all of the individuals in the company have to follow, we're not haggling, you pay what we list, has moral implications, both in terms of justice, but then in terms of the moral formation of, you know, at least subconsciously, I'm sure the dealer salesmen realize, you know, hey, I can get more money from this black couple in here trying to get a car, because just the way that all the other dealers are going to treat them, they're going to have a hard time getting a better deal. And that's discrimination. And so we don't want, you know, we don't want to be shaped in that way where we're acting in those behaviors. So it's significant. That's just a local business changing their policies, you know, their institutional rules. You can go all the way up as big as, you know, requirements put in by the government. So regulations on the stock market, for example, trying to rein in, you know, arbitrage and speculation that might be detrimental to the volatility of the market and the safety of the retirement plans of the United States. But it's also going to be shaping the way that we invest because of the rules determining who can invest, how, you know, what sorts of, you know, crazy complicated options are available. Credit default swaps, notoriously from 2008, are these permissible? That's going to change the way that people on the stock market interact with it. And so institutionally, you know, we can be looking at governments down to just your small business owner. And I think everything in between, because if markets are constructed, if we're assigning different rules, then all of us have varying degrees of power and influence to change certain markets.
I think a lot of people, like, you can see something like a payday loan and say, yes, that's clearly predatory and should be outlawed or something like that. And even, you know, the discrimination case you've given here, the car dealership seems pretty straightforward to me. But there, over the last several years, I feel like there's probably been a reaction to some degree of sort of justice and justice language talk, discrimination talk, rightly or wrongly. And so there might be some skepticism and suspicion of saying there's still some level of widespread discrimination or injustice in our markets. So would you say, yes, there still is, and here are some other examples based on this data, or how would you go about explaining that?
Yeah, I would say there's still injustice. I would clarify, in teaching social ethics, I try to stay away from the word racism because it can mean a million different things. And I try and break it down into subcategories. And so one of those would be bigotry. You know, you just have feelings of hatred toward a certain ethnic group or a certain race. Or it could be gender bigotry. I don't think the data necessarily bears out that is the fundamental problem. I mean, sure, there are still bigots around. But consistently, these audit and correspondence studies are finding differences based on race. And the main defense that some economists have had is actually it's a matter of uncertainty. Because, a correspondence study, you send in applications, they're fake, you know, but you'll have two applicants, they're both, you know, from an Ivy League school, both 5 years of relevant experience, both, you know, whatever. And then you have a picture on the resume. And one of the pictures is for a Latino and the other is for someone who's white. And then you just see what's the difference. And one of the main defenses by economists is, well, the problem is the information asymmetry. The person doing hiring doesn't know that much except what's on your resume. So you both went to Harvard. You both have good GPAs. But the Latino individual... just statistically speaking, this is just math. We're not bigots here. The Latino individual is more likely to come from a poorer school district, and so more likely to have that weaker background. And so there's probably going to be more variability. This might be an actual stronger candidate because they had to overcome that limited background, or it might be a weaker candidate because of that background. And because we don't know, we're going to avoid the risk. And therefore, we're going to hire the white individual. And so that's what the economists say is happening. It's not bigotry. It's not hatred. It's avoiding risk to fulfill the financial responsibility of the corporation to be financially healthy, you know, maximizing profit, among other things. You might say, well, that's less morally objectionable, right? Except for the problem that these studies have applied for mortgages. So if the Latino family wants to get a mortgage to move into a wealthier community to have better schools, they're less likely to be approved. Why? Because they're not getting the jobs because of the same sorts of patterns of hiring. Well, what about educationally? Well, you know, it's difficult to, especially, and this is a whole complex ethical argument, but especially with the more diminished acceptance of affirmative action, you know, some of this is happening in collegiate level. You want to buy a car? Well, studies are finding that it's happening with cars. And each of those locations can say, well, we don't want to give a loan because look at the value of the property. It's not going to be as high. Look at the job this individual has. It's not going to be as stable, so we're not going to give you the loan. Well, we don't want to give you the job because look at your education. Well, and so it's all fit together. And so we're moving from bigotry to, you know, systems of injustice. And I do think the economic studies bear out that over the last several decades, not just in the United States, in many places around the world, there are these systems that we need to figure out a way to break through. And the book's not about that. I don't have a nice, here's a three-step political policy to solve that. But those are economic experiments that are prevalent enough that I would find it hard to say, oh, everything is perfectly equal. We don't need to think about this, even while the data doesn't bear out that it's mostly just, you know, people that, you know, white people that hate people of color. That's not what the data is really showing either.
Yeah. And I mean, obviously, like you said, the book's not about it, but I think the sort of ethics of it are super interesting to think about. I mean, do individuals or institutions or even governments have a moral obligation to work to reverse some of these things? Because I guess some of my concern would be, are we going to ultimately sort of basically in attempting to solve this problem, we're going to reverse the problem. Mm-hmm. And so to some degree, I'm like, I look at people and they're incompetent. And so like, which every time somebody asks me about a conspiracy theory, I'm like, well, have you looked at how incompetent people are at a large scale? So the likelihood of this conspiracy theory is low just because of that. But I'm thinking about like the obligations to resolve some of this. How much responsibility do individuals, institutions, and then nations or states have to solve some of these common problems?
Yeah. I think that's going to vary depending on, you know, what institutions you're talking about. You know, the government arguably has a duty and responsibility to all of its citizens to establish, you know, a just and equitable society. Huge asterisk there. We have to define what justice and equitability are. You know, I wouldn't say it's exactly identical outcomes for everyone. And that's one whole realm of debate that is complicated by the reality of sin and ignorance. I don't necessarily advocate a massive centrally planned society. Even while government intervention is happening a whole lot in our, you know, free market society. So we need to pay attention to what they're doing and how they can do it better. But I do argue in the book that my identity in Christ through justification is one that makes me a part of the body of Christ. And it's one that therefore, through that union with Christ into his body, requires me to view other Christians as believers. And I go a step further than that. The fact that anyone could become a believer makes anyone a potential brother and sister in Christ, a potential family member, even beyond that common humanity of bearing the image of God together. And so if that's what my identity is and how I'm supposed to be acting so that there is neither Jew nor Gentile, for all are one in Christ, you know, in Galatians there, then if my company, if my economy is training me to be, quote, risk averse, and say, well, if I hire someone who's Latino, if I give this loan to a family that's Black, then it's more risky for my company, I'm not going to do it, then I'm being trained in patterns of action and thought that are contrary to the identity I'm supposed to be having in Christ. And so that deeply troubles me. I don't have, again, a nice, oh, well, here's a three-step answer to solve the financial sector's issues here. In fact, we need to be very cautious when we come to market design, because past efforts to do this have been catastrophic. I talk a little bit about trying to reverse redlining with sort of positive interventions. And a great scholar, Kianga Yamada Taylor, argues, well, that ends up being predatory inclusion, because they're so busy trying to force people into the system that next thing you know, a lot of people aren't able to make their mortgage payments because they didn't get any better job opportunities. So they don't have more income. And so, yeah, it's come Lord Jesus. it's a massive problem. But I don't think it's one we can stick our head in the sand on. And I may not be smart enough to figure out how we fix this, but I can at least shine a spotlight on it. And I'm only one part of the body of Christ, in hopes that others can take us a step closer.
Yeah. So Glenn, tell me this. I mean, from my vantage point, there's not a ton of like sort of work, what you're doing, like theological, economic sort of related stuff. Am I missing it? I'm assuming there's probably a lot more in the Catholic sphere than there is in Protestant areas. Mm-hmm. Maybe that's part of it, just the circles I run in. But is there a reason that you think that's the case, if it is?
Ooh, that's a big question. I would say I think a lot of people are doing theology and economics, but among the mainline church and among Catholicism. And I tend to find many of my favorite dialogue partners from the Catholic tradition, even though my favorite, my dissertation director, Steve Long, is Methodist. But a lot of times more Protestant liberalism engaging in this has lost, I think, some of the theological foundations that are necessary. And so coming at this from, I'm going to take Michel Foucault and apply it to the economy. That's interesting, but that's not really my Christian avenue. I'm trying to take justification, the Trinity, providence. I've been asking myself that. I went to the Evangelical Theological Society, you know, was it a month ago?
Yeah.
And just the number of ethicists there relative to the number of theologians and relative to the number of biblical scholars is quite small. And I don't quite know why that is. And then among the ethicists, many of them specialize in the very important areas of sexual ethics, family ethics, bioethics, and we need that. But the couple of individuals I can think of from an evangelical perspective that have written on theology and economics, I actually work with one now. And so, I'm trying to think of others. Wayne Grudem, I would have a rather different perspective than he does. Scott Ray has done some on this. But there just aren't very many evangelicals. And so I hope, though sales may indicate against this, but I hope to inspire some more, you know, conservative Protestants to think about this and write on this.
And
hopefully some economists. I've actually probably gotten more attention from economists than from theologians, which is
interesting. That's awesome.
Yeah.
So what are you working on right now? Do you have any new books that you're working on that you anticipate being available in the next couple of years?
I do. So Lord willing, I'm hoping to finish. I'm working on I wrote Trinitarian Dogmatics, just sort of a survey of the doctrine of the Trinity. I'm hoping to finish Christological Dogmatics, the second volume in that, by the end of the day Thursday. We're recording on Tuesday here, so that I can go home to Christmas with the family and not have it over my head as it's past due. So that'll come out in about a year.
Fantastic.
I've pitched a book on immigration, looking at territorial sovereignty. I don't know if that's going to get picked up. And then I have a book on a theological account of virtue. I'm supposed to submit in 2027, so it'll be out 28, 29, something like that.
Yeah.
So a long way away.
Fantastic. Well, Glenn, this has been an absolute delight and pleasure. I always enjoy talking to you. And I think our interests probably overlap pretty significantly because everything you're writing on, I'm interested in.
Yeah, I mean, everything that I see you guys doing over at London Lyceum, I'm really appreciating. So
cool.
Hanover Press and all the other things. So,
well, thanks. Yeah, thanks for the shout out there.
Yeah.
So I'll remind you all to go check out the quality work we've got in there. I'm excited about some of the titles that we're working on. But Glenn, this has been great. So as a reminder, go ahead and pick up a copy of the book, especially if it's still for $6. Like, that's a no-brainer that you need to skip the bad coffee from Starbucks or skip the pour over from wherever you go from those third wave places and get a copy of the book. And it's more valuable, in my opinion. So thanks, Glenn. This has been great.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
Yeah, everybody's been listening. Thanks for tuning in to the only analytic Baptist and confessional podcast on the planet. And we'll talk to you all soon.
New year, same great savings. All in the Kroger app. Get Kroger Spiral Sliced Ham for 89 cents a pound with your card and an additional $25 purchase limit too. Then get large avocados or mangoes for 99 cents each with your card and a digital coupon. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.